WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Journalist Elaine Chelino was the first woman to interview the Ayatollah Khomeini. She was later expelled from Iran. She was also briefly imprisoned in Syria and shot at in Beirut. But she says of all the countries in the Middle East, she's always found Iraq the toughest to penetrate and the hardest to like. She attributes that to Saddam Hussein, who virtually eliminated Iraq's Western educated elite and produced a generation of people who know nothing but propaganda and the rule of fear. She last visited Iraq 2 weeks before the war. Chelino has written for the New York Times since 1984 and is now a diplomatic correspondent in the Washington Bureau. She covered the war from Washington and continues to write about its aftermath. Chelino first reported on Saddam Hussein's brutal regime in a 1985 cover story for the New York Times magazine. Now she's written a book about Saddam's Iraq, and she calls it the outlaw state.
Well, I like to call Saddam an outlaw. A gunman. There are probably three different types of leaders in the Middle East. One is the Messiah. Ayatollah Khomeini was the quintessential Messiah. He had the ability to inspire people to action through his words, through his charisma. He may not have looked very charismatic to us, but this man led a truly popular revolution that has lasted now for 12 years. Another type of Middle Eastern leader is the merchant. This is the one that we're more familiar with. The guy we can talk to, the one that we can negotiate with. Assad is a merchant. He knows the rules of the bazaar. He knows what limits there are. He may use force, even like someone like Saddam, but he knows where to stop. Saddam is truly an outlaw. I like to think of him as a gunman. He's the kind of guy who robs the bank and then gets caught in the bank, the doors of the bank lock behind him, the alarm bells off and go off, and he has to decide, do I stay and shoot it out, or do I unilaterally retreat? And this is the way he grew up. This is the way he always was as a young Ba'ath Party leader, and this is the way he still is today. It's something that we really didn't understand about him.
Do you think he doesn't have skills to negotiate?
I think he's devoid of negotiating skills. I think that if you look at his personal background, it becomes very understandable. He grew up in a very, very small village that had no running water, not even a paved road. It was a very harsh existence. He never knew his father. He owned a gun from the time he was 10 years old. And you often read political biographies of Saddam Hussein that say he quickly rose through the ranks of the Ba'ath Party. Well, this didn't mean he was sitting in cafes in Cairo discussing the nuances of party politics or Arab socialism. He was the gunman. He was the hitman, the one who would raid the other Ba'ath Party leaders' safe houses and steal all the weapons. This is how he rose through the ranks.
Now, you were on to Saddam Hussein in 1985. You had a cover story in the New York Times Sunday magazine. This was when the United States and Iraq were reestablishing relations, which had been broken off after the Arab defeat in the 67 war with Israel. How did you get on to him? Maybe I just wasn't paying attention, but I don't remember seeing a lot written in the press then about what a horrible dictator Saddam Hussein was and what a dangerous leader he was.
I think that was the case because we in the West so much wanted to like Iraq because we hated Iran so much. This was the height of the Iran-Iraq war. We were still suffering from the post-hostage trauma, the American hostages that had been held captive for over a year in Iran. And there was really a willingness on the part of the United States government, as well as our allies and our Arab allies as well, to give Saddam the benefit of the doubt. I looked at it, though, through the specter of Iran, and because I had spent a lot of time in Iran during the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis. And I remember the first time I went to Iraq, I really didn't like the place because it was such a difficult country to work in. And I realized that even in Iran, which was more difficult in many ways as a woman, you had to be covered, you had limited access, I felt freer because there were little holes through which you could move in order to penetrate the system. I found Iraq impenetrable, and I felt that we were missing the boat on Iraq and that we didn't quite understand who we were dealing with, and that Saddam Hussein was merely preaching a message of moderation, even though he was committed to a vision that was expansionist, and that I thought he would revert to once the Iran-Iraq war was over.
You went to Iraq right before the war started, about 2 weeks before the war. You were in Iraq and stayed there till just about the start of the war, right?
Yes.
How did it feel to be flying to Iraq at a time when really everybody would have been wanting to get out of there, not go there?
Well, I can't say that I was scared, because I never felt in any physical danger flying back into Iraq. I think because I knew the country. I actually had a colleague who was there. There were a number of Western journalists there. And what one does when one is in a difficult situation is you cling together with your colleagues or with Western diplomats. And I did know some people in Baghdad. And I had already cabled ahead saying that I was coming. To me, it was much scarier, for example, flying to Iran with Ayatollah Khomeini on his plane when he went back to Iran during the Iranian Revolution, because we didn't know whether or not the Shah was going to allow us to land. It was much scarier flying a Soviet-made helicopter to the Iran-Iraq border and covering the Iran-Iraq war, because the Iranians were trying to shoot down our helicopter. It was scarier driving around Lebanon during the time when the American Marines were in Lebanon. So I think that once I got to the airport in Amman and I saw that the plane was full, much to my surprise, with people who were wanting to go back to Iraq, even mothers and children, I felt much calmer, even though now I'm a mother of two and doing those other things I was not.
Did you feel bad picking up as the mother of two and flying to Iraq? I think this is the kind of thing that reporters really have to deal with.
I felt horrible.
Yeah.
And it has changed my view of being a war correspondent, which is something that I did for a number of years.
That was largely before you had children, that you were a war correspondent?
Yes, that's right.
And you don't feel like you'd want to do it now?
I think I would be very careful. And what I even do now is I weigh assignments. And I think to myself, do I really want to be away from my two children, who are ages 2 and 1, for a month? And is this assignment really worth it? Where before, when I was asked, would you please go to X country for 6 to 8 weeks, I would jump on a plane and go.
I know it's become something of a sport for Middle East experts to predict how long Saddam Hussein is going to stay in power. And for that reason, I regret asking you that question. Yet I'm really curious to see what you think, since you've been following his story for so long.
Until someone can prove to me that he has weakened, I'm going to think he's going to remain in power indefinitely. I have never thought that he was in risk of being overthrown. There's one thing you can say about the Middle East and be pretty sure, that most things are going to remain the same. You know, we said during the crisis, or many Middle East experts said during the crisis, the Middle East will never be the same again. There are going to be all of these changes. Well, what are we seeing? We're seeing a lot of things remaining the same, including the fact that Saddam Hussein is in power. He's consolidated power. He's put members of his family in very important positions around him. He has circled the wagons the way he has always done in the past in times of crisis. He has a reliable elite Republican Guard that did come through for him during a very difficult civil war. He's in good health. Iraq has been allowed back into the Arab League, so we have every reason to believe that Iraq will be assimilated back into the Arab fold in one way or another.
What do you see changing now in terms of how Saddam Hussein holds the reins of power? You wrote recently that he's talking about democratizing, but what he's really doing is bringing in a lot more of his family into positions of power.
Well, one of the principles that I explain in the book, and I think it's a key to understanding Iraq, is the duality of terror and enticement. In Arabic, it's called tarhib and targhib. What we sometimes forget is that Saddam doesn't rule by terror alone. Terror is a crucial element, and it's an overriding element. But if he ruled by terror alone, then all the people of Iraq would have risen up against him, and he may have been overthrown. But he's able to entice the people, too. He buys off the Iraqi people, and there is a genuine segment of the Iraqi population that owes everything to Saddam Hussein. I think that's what you're seeing now with various moves towards democracy. You're seeing these negotiations that are going on now with the Kurds that may end up in some sort of accord that will give the Kurds more autonomy. There are promises to hold elections. There are promises to have a 7-year presidency. There is a commitment to have more freedom of the press, to lift the travel ban. I look at this, and as far as I'm concerned, it's all window dressing. I have not seen any real fundamental change in Saddam Hussein, in his behavior, in his conspiracy theory, in his propaganda.
My guest is New York Times reporter Elaine Shalino. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is New York Times reporter Elaine Shalino, and she reported on the war throughout the war. Mostly she was based in Washington, but for the 2 weeks prior to the war, she was in Baghdad. She's written a new book about Saddam Hussein and the Gulf crisis, and it's called The Outlaw State. You've traveled around the Middle East writing about most of the countries there. You've been doing that for years. What are some of the considerations that you have to take into account as a woman journalist traveling through the Middle East that a man probably would not have to worry about?
Well, this is going to sound very sexist, but the first thing you have to worry about is your wardrobe. When I go to a place like Saudi Arabia, I tend to wear long, loose fitting dresses and a hat. It was interesting during the Gulf crisis.
A hat out of modesty? I mean,
yes.
Modesty in quotes.
Well,
you know?
A hat because I don't like to be stared at when I walk down the streets, and I want to walk down the street.
So a hat to cover your hair and everything?
A hat to cover my head, mm-hmm. And it gives you protection against the sun, but it also protects you from staring Saudis who are also on the street, or Yemeni workmen who look and see a Western woman walking down the street in a funny-looking robe that isn't the same thing that a Saudi woman would wear. A Saudi woman wouldn't be walking down the street anyway. I've always erred on the side of caution and have always dressed very modestly throughout the Middle East. It just makes life easier. In Iran, I would cover my hair with a scarf and wear pants and then some sort of a knee-length robe over it. In a country, even a country like Egypt, I wouldn't wear a sleeveless dress, although you can wear regular clothes, as you can in a country like Iraq. So your first sensibility has to be, do I have a versatile, comfortable wardrobe that is, in certain countries, is not going to get me banned from getting into the Ministry of Information, and also is going to make me feel comfortable? Other than wardrobe, I have always found it easier to work in the Middle East than in, easier than I think some of my male colleagues might even find it, because in most places you're still in the minority if you're a woman working in the Middle East. Although I think that what the recent Persian Gulf crisis has proven is that women can do anything, and it has raised the sensibility not only of Americans but of the Arab countries in which the women worked, that they, first of all, could be soldiers, they could be mechanics, and they could be journalists as well. So that this is probably the first time that a country like Saudi Arabia, for example, has had to confront so many professional Western women. And there may be some changes in the way they treat foreign women in the future, although I doubt there'll be many changes in how they treat their own women.
You had said that in some ways you thought you had it easier than your male counterparts in the Middle East. So in what ways?
Well, for example, I was once arrested in Syria and briefly put into prison there, but I was put into what is probably considered a 4-star prison. It was a basement. It was a prison in the basement of a lovely villa in a residential neighborhood. I had a female roommate. We had a clean cell. There was even a little window in the corner. There wasn't any furniture, but the male prison guards made an effort to be gracious and polite. And they probably were more gracious and polite than they would be if I were a man. There have been other cases where I know it helped me to be a woman. For example, in Libya, I'm sure that I would not have interviewed Colonel Gaddafi a number of years ago if I hadn't been a woman.
Why not?
Because he likes women journalists, and he tends to give interviews to women reporters.
How do you mean that? I mean, does he try to seduce women journalists? You mean it on that level?
Yes, he does that too.
Did he try to seduce you?
He locked me in his office when the interview was over.
and that's
about all I ever tell about what happened when that room when that's about all I ever say about what happened in that room, because I don't know if I have to go back to Libya someday.
Oh my goodness. So, but you held your own, I take it.
I got out to tell the story.
All right, so this is an example of what your male counterparts probably don't have to go through.
There's one place where it's harder to be a woman reporter, and that's in Iran, because the Iranians still cannot deal with women traveling with men. For example, if at this stage I wanted to go to Iranian Kurdistan and visit the Iraqi Kurds, I might have it might be difficult. It might be difficult to travel to Iranian Kurdistan because the Iranians would say there aren't enough facilities for you as a woman. Once I was not allowed to go to the Iran-Iraq war front on the Iranian side for that reason. They said no women are allowed to go to the front. And despite the fact I said, well, I was just allowed to go to the war front 2 weeks ago,
Yeah. They
said, well, the rules have changed. But this is a country where the separation of the sexes is still a factor.
I got to ask you one more thing about this Colonel Gaddafi scene. Did you threaten that you would write about it, that the world would know if he persisted?
What I said to him, and it's been a long time since I've thought about this, but I said to him, people say that you're a terrorist, and I don't know if it's true, but you are certainly terrorizing me right now. So I would feel a lot better if you unlocked the door and let me go.
Was that effective?
I think he got the point after a few minutes, yes.
One of the more amazing things that's happened to you is you managed to fly with the Ayatollah Khomeini from Paris to Iran when he was ending his exile. How did you get to do that?
Well, at the time, I was the junior member of a bureau, Newsweek magazine's bureau in Paris. It was a 5-person bureau, and I was the low person on the totem pole. And early in those days, in the early days of Ayatollah Khomeini's exile, nobody took him seriously. He was just looked at as still another political exile in Paris who had sought political asylum. And I, as the junior member of the bureau, went out and interviewed him very early on. And soon he became very important. And people who never knew what an Ayatollah was suddenly had to take him very seriously. So that when it came time to send someone on his plane back to Iran, Newsweek magazine put me on his plane. And not only put me on his plane, but let me stay in Iran for 2 months and cover that revolution. And it was one of the first times that Newsweek did allow a woman to cover that sort of story.
You said earlier in our interview that that flight back was one of the times when you felt you were truly in jeopardy. What was the most frightening part of that? What were the dangers?
When we neared Tehran, we had no idea whether or not the Shah's troops would allow the plane to land. Ayatollah Khomeini was the Shah's enemy. He was coming to foment revolution. And we circled the airport for, half an hour, 45 minutes before we had landing rights. And we looked out over the airfield and could see the Shah's troops below us and had no sense whether or not we would be fired on either in the air or when we landed on the ground. And even Ayatollah Khomeini knew that because it was a conscious decision to take journalists on that flight with him. And we were his first hostages, in a sense. And when it came time for us to disembark, the journalists got off the plane first.
Oh, wow. So he was, like, in a way hiding behind the journalists.
No question.
When you were on the plane with him and when you were talking with him, did you feel like you had to wear the veil that Iranian women wear? And I ask that because I know when Oriana Fallaci had her interview with him, she wore the chador and then, as I recall, ripped it off in the middle of the interview and refused to wear it any longer. But I think that was part of how she got in to talk with him.
I never made that big a deal out of having to wear a headscarf in Ayatollah Khomeini's presence. I mean, we even had to wear headscarves to go see him in Paris. And I guess we could have made a political statement and tried to fight it, but then we wouldn't have gotten access to the story. And my feeling is, you know, if Ayatollah Khomeini is a religious leader, and if he feels better having a woman be dressed in a headscarf, then I will respect that because he's a religious leader. I was Rome bureau chief for Newsweek for 3 years and traveled with the Pope. Now, I would never wear a red dress traveling on the Pope's flight, and I'd never wear a sleeveless dress. And it was just, I'd never wear a really short skirt. Now, it wasn't that I would be thrown off the plane, but just as a mark of respect towards a religious leader. I mean, you can't even get into the Vatican if you've got shorts on.
How did you end up specializing in the Middle East?
It was really by chance. As I told you earlier, I was based in Paris for Newsweek magazine. The first time I ever went to the Middle East, it was to cover a wedding. It was to cover King Hussein's wedding because they wanted a woman to cover the wedding. And they needed someone to describe Queen Noor's Christian Dior dress with the white crepe dress with the faggoting around the neckline. And that was my first trip. And my second entree into the Middle East was Ayatollah Khomeini. It was because of him that I got to know Iran, and that was how I became a quote-unquote Iran specialist, as we all become specialists very quickly in our profession.
Elaine Shalino, it's really been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. This is really fun.
Elaine Shalino is a reporter for The New York Times and the author of the new book, The Outlaw State, Saddam Hussein's Quest for Power and the Gulf Crisis. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.